Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is Elizabeth Woodworth. Elizabeth is a writer. She's a former head librarian for the British Columbia Ministry of Health. Her writing focuses largely on social justice issues, and she's involved in a very important initiative. It's called Consensus 9/11. Well, you know, stories about 9/11 usually surface on or around the occasion, the anniversary of the 9/11 event, but it's always a good time to talk about 9/11. Without question, it's the most important event of our time. Look what's happened in the wake of that momentous day. I just can't imagine how much I've written about the fallout from what happened on that day. I was suspicious from the start, but I knew nothing. The whole event just didn't seem right to me. It took a while to really get involved and piped in to realize we were systematically lied to. Well, Consensus 9/11 seeks best evidence to really explain what went on. Maybe one day they'll come up with an incontrovertible smoking gun. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Not certain what you would do to go after the rogues that planned this thing. It certainly wasn't the people who we said did it. As far as I'm concerned, it was a slam-dunk state-sponsored affair. But anyway, Elizabeth is on this all the time. She worked closely with David Ray Griffin and other important people who were on this story, wanting to bring real truth to people, understanding of what the 9/11 event was really all about. Elizabeth, I welcome you, and you have some new information that you want to share with listeners. I'm going to let you dive right into it.
Yes, good morning, Stephen, and thank you. First, I'd like to say there is a smoking gun, the one that we anchor everything to, and that was the collapse of the 47-story steel frame building, World Trade Center 7, which was the base the size of a football field, and it was a steel frame building, and it came down in 6.25 seconds. And with the parallel roof line, it just came straight down in its own footprint. And there's only one way that could happen, and that was controlled demolition. So we know that for sure. And everything else has to tie into that fact, the fact that that building was never considered in the 9/11 Commission report. It was deliberately left out, and it took them 7 years to come up with a government report explaining the fall of that building. And in the end, they said that it had fallen from fire, so that all 82 steel columns that supported that building collapsed simultaneously from fire. And that's impossible.
Well, of course, the towers, I believe both of them, came down pretty much in their own footprint as well, Elizabeth. Isn't that right?
That's true. But there are all kinds of engineering theories about why they came down. But they didn't come down quite as fast as World Trade Center 7, which was in absolute free fall for 2.25 seconds, the first 100 feet that it fell. And even the NIST, the government agency, the scientific agency, they said it did come down in free fall, but it came down from fire. And those two things cannot be true together. So that's the very, very foundation of all the doubt that comes out about 9/11. It's the smoking gun, as you say. And but we do have I should explain a little bit about our consensus panel. It uses the same procedures for getting to its best evidence that are used in medicine. And these procedures have only been around for about 20 years, where you have panels of experts reviewing evidence, say about the best protocols for treating diabetes, for example, and they use a technique where all the people who are examining the evidence are blind to one another, and they go through a series of reviews of the evidence, all blind to one another, and then after maybe 3 rounds of reviews and feedback, they refine the evidence to the point where everybody agrees. And our panel, our Consensus 9/11 panel of 20 experts, including 6 PhDs, 3 attorneys, 4 journalists, and 3 commercial airline pilots, we use the same technique in arriving at our consensus points about 9/11, and we now have 32 of them. And we've just released the last four yesterday. So this is good timing to have our interview today, Stephen.
Oh, that really is wonderful. Absolutely wonderful. I had no idea of the timing when I scheduled you on the program, Elizabeth, but it's wonderful that this information came out so you can share it with listeners.
Yes. Well, the set five, we're on set five now, the set that just went up on the website yesterday, which is consensus911.org, and we also have Twitter. We're just simply at consensus911. We have these four points, and the first one is about the Todd Beamer calls from Flight 93. And Todd Beamer was the celebrated hero that it was all over the media, that he was part of a group of passengers that were preparing to make a move to take over Flight 93, which was the one that was headed for Washington and subsequently crashed in a field in Shanksville. And
supposedly crashed in a field with a little help from a few F-16s, I guess, Elizabeth.
Could have been. Oh, we haven't looked into those yet, but he said, his famous words were, "Are you guys ready?" to his fellow passengers, "Okay, let's roll." So they were going to take over this plane. And this... This fact was conveyed, it was made known by a woman that he had a 13-minute telephone conversation with. She was a supervisor at GTE. Her name was Lisa Jefferson. And however, her interview did not, with the FBI, she had an interview the same morning with the FBI, and she did not say anything about let's roll in that FBI interview, which is very interesting. Now, according to the FBI interview with her, the plane had been hijacked, and he saw two hijackers with knives and someone else enter the cockpit. But Jefferson said, this was the GTE supervisor, he sounded so tranquil, it made me begin to doubt the authenticity and urgency of his call. The very interesting thing is she had a switch where she could have thrown a switch to record the interview, and she didn't do that. There's no record of this 13-minute conversation that she had with him while he was stricken up in the on Flight 93. She said after he mentioned "Let's roll," the line went silent after the 13 minutes, and she kept the phone line open for another 15 minutes, and she never heard the crash. She had the phone line open to his whatever phone he was using for 15 minutes after the plane reportedly crashed. And she said, "I can't explain it. We didn't lose a connection because there's a different sound that you use. It's a squealing sound when you lose a connection. I never lost connection. It just went silent." There, I can get further into this point, but we have four of them.
I guess from my own recollections and what I've written about in the past, it's been a good while, Elizabeth, the notion that you could place a cell phone call from an aircraft above a certain altitude, the technology did not exist to let that be possible at the time. So I forget the altitude the plane was at, but apparently it was too high to permit a cell phone call to be made. Am I saying that accurately?
That's true. We look further into that idea in one of the next points that we're going to be talking about. So we can kind of save that. I have more specific information for that in a few minutes.
Okay.
There was one more thing that one very strange thing is that on September 29th, 2001, the FBI received detailed records from Verizon. That's the telephone company that runs the phone system. They received detailed records from Verizon's wireless that Todd Beamer's cell phone made 19 outgoing calls after the alleged 10:03 a.m. crash time of flight United Airlines 93. So that really makes you wonder what was going on. The records are actually available online, and you can see if you go to the website and look at this point, which is called PC1, the Todd Beamer calls from Flight 93, you can go to the document that shows where those calls. Everything we do is supported right to the hilt with references. A lot of them are government references.
I think that is so important. When I made the smoking gun comment at the opening of the program, what I would love to see one day is that somebody brave and bold enough who was involved in this heinous event and simply can't tolerate the fallout from it, the endless wars and all the rest, and just damning the torpedoes, as an old U.S. admiral, I believe, or British admiral maybe once said, hey, the British or American, you know, damn the torpedoes, and I simply cannot go to my grave not explaining the big lie behind this program. I was there. I was involved in the planning. I knew all the details, and here's the way it was planned, and here's the way it went down.
Yes, it would be wonderful if somebody would do that, somebody directly involved in it. It's interesting, though, like the people who actually conceived the plan and designed the whole thing, which we suspect were in the military, a rogue faction of the military, that could be carried out through a lot of other people who wouldn't know that they were involved. You know, people could be doing aspects of that, carrying out aspects of the plan without realizing that what they were doing.
Oh, I agree with you, Elizabeth. And one of the counterarguments to what I just said was, how could you have a lot of people involved in this and expect nobody is going to say anything? Well, I imagine only a few, maybe a select few people who were reliable, quote-unquote, not to say anything. Maybe they were the only ones who knew the whole dirty story, and other people who may have been involved in what you're saying had no idea what was going on.
That's right. I suppose it'll all come out one day, and we're trying our best to help it to come out. But a lot of people would be dead by then, and it won't be possible to talk to them about it.
Oh, that's exactly right. And of course, we're still debating who killed Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, and the people who were blamed for doing it had nothing to do with it. And you could go back to Lincoln and other U.S. presidents who were either assassinated or attempts to assassinate them. And my point always is, I don't care who pulls the trigger or does anything else. I care only about who ordered it done and why.
That's exactly right, Stephen. Exactly right. I can go on to the next point if you like.
Oh, absolutely. Please do.
Okay. The next point is Barbara Olson. She was a famous CNN commentator, and she was married to Ted Olson, who was the Solicitor General of the United States. Two very well-known, high-profile names. And it's very interesting that much of what came through about what was happening on the planes that morning came through Ted Olson. So two people that everybody knew. That, to begin with, that's a little odd, isn't it? So the Americans were first told that terrorists had hijacked an airliner when Barbara called Ted twice that morning from Flight 77, that's the one that allegedly hit the Pentagon, saying that terrorists had taken over her flight. Now, his report, he said the first call lasted 1 minute and the second one from 3 to 4 minutes. He vacillated back and forth over the next several weeks about whether she'd used her cell phone or a seat back phone. But she could not have used either because the elevation was too high for a cell phone. And a page from the Boeing aircraft maintenance manual, dated January 28, 2001, said that the passenger phone system for the American Airlines 757 fleet had been deactivated before January 2001. We have emails from airline staff, a commercial pilot and a flight attendant have confirmed that the deactivation stickers were on the phones, you know, back earlier in the year. So she couldn't have done either phone call. Furthermore, there were no records made public to confirm her calls. There were no seatback system records, no records from Ted Olson's office, and no records from Barbara's cell phone. None of those are available anywhere on the Internet or in the government literature, and nobody ever released that information. However, in addition to this, the FBI had to present telephone records under oath to the Moussaoui trial in 2006. And when they were presenting evidence under oath, they showed that only one call from Barbara Olson was made to her husband, Ted, and that one call was disconnected and lasted 0 seconds. So the whole Olson story is implausible. The hijackers were small men, very slight build, and they were 5'5" to 5'7" high. They had only knives and box cutters, and there were 59 passengers and crew on Flight 77 that morning, and the pilot was a weightlifter and a boxer. And it's just none of it. There's no real evidence to support the fact that Barbara Olson called her husband with that information.
Oh, I do remember that. I do remember Barbara Olson and Ted Olson. Another gem of an important piece of information that just rips apart the official story, Elizabeth. But you go on.
Okay, we've done two of them. The third new point from the 9/11 consensus panel is point PC3. The cell phone call. Now this is cell phone calls from the planes, and the first official account, like the story about the cell phone calls evolved as information was coming out that the first account could not be correct. So the public understanding about the 9/11 attacks depended from the beginning on media reports of cell phone calls from the planes. From the time of the attacks in September 2001 until the time the 9/11 Commission report was issued, there was no official statement about the reported calls, so the media reports, by default, were the first official story. And from these reports, these media reports, America learned of the whole story, Muslim hijackers, knives, box cutters, red bandanas, and flight takeovers. The FBI and the 9/11, the FBI never questioned these media reports. There were 15 reported cell phone calls that were taken down in evidence when the FBI interviewed the recipients of the calls on 9/11 itself. So the problems with this is that several experiments have been done showing that cell phone calls in 2001 could not connect for more than a few seconds from the altitude that these calls were made. This was confirmed by San Diego's Telecom Council back in October 2001. Qualcomm, I guess that's a telephone company, announced in 2004 that...
I think it's a technology company that makes... I don't know all the products they make, Elizabeth, but I guess they make products that go into cell phones, maybe another communication devices.
Is that what they do?
I think that's what they do, something like that.
Something like that. Well, they announced in 2004, 3 years later, that they now had a new technology that would allow customers to send and receive calls as if they were on the ground. And they said that that would be installed in planes in 2006. So this is really problematic, that all this evidence that has been cited to support the idea of hijackers being on the planes came through cell phone calls. That's what fleshed out the whole dramatic public story, and it seems highly unlikely. So as a result of all that speculation that was going on the internet about how, you know, this story just can't be true, there was a change to what we call the second official account. And the second version became obvious in the FBI's testimony at the Moussaoui trial, which I mentioned earlier, in early 2006. Under oath, the FBI said that now, instead of 15 cell phone calls that had been reported through the media, only 2 cell phone calls had been made, and that these were from 5,000 feet or lower. And, you know, there is some possibility that a cell phone call can be maintained at that elevation. It certainly can't be maintained over 10,000 feet, or it couldn't in 2001. So these 2 calls they identified were from Flight 93, one from Edward Felt. His call was reportedly, he said he was in the washroom, and C.C. Lyles. The FBI has created a graphic showing all the phone calls that were made that morning, and that can be seen online. If you go to the consensus911.org website, you can see the link to this. Actually, it's a very interesting graphic. It's easy to watch, and it shows everything that was presented at the Moussaoui trial. Now, there are problems with saying that there were just 2 cell phone calls. One of them is that all the seatback phone calls, which you can see online, the times and the durations and so on, and in this graphic, they show the minutes and the exact time the call was made in minutes and seconds. But the 2 cell phone calls that they show were given at the exact precise moment at 9:58.00 seconds a.m. And there was no cell phone numbers given, nor any duration. So that makes that does not reflect information from a record. It's just a claim. So this new second official story that we're talking about now, with only 2 cell phone calls made, shows that the first story was untrue. So why should we believe the second one? Why is that more true? Now, the second story says that calls by 7 of the passengers, and they're listed in the point, I won't mention their names here, had been misidentified. All these people whose call recipients said that they had been called on their cell phones, 7 of these people had been misidentified as making cell phone calls. And that seems very unlikely. And there are 2 calls in particular that it's absolutely proved that they were cell phone calls. And one of them was a 27-second call received by Julie Sweeney from her husband Brian's cell phone on her answering machine. And she got home. She wasn't there at the time he called. And she got home, and there's his cell phone number right on the machine. And that was also true of Dina Burnett. She was a former flight attendant, and she received 3 to 5 calls on her answering machine from her husband, Tom Burnett. When Flight 93 was high up in the air, it was up around 25,000 feet, and she saw his cell phone number, his cell phone caller ID on her machine. So, and not only that, but she gave that information to the FBI right on the very date of 9/11. So she, within hours of seeing his caller ID. So, in conclusion, with this set of 4 points, we say that the idea that all 7 of the reported cell phone calls, aside from those by Felt and Lyles, were due to errors is really unlikely, and that 2 of the reported cell phone calls simply can't be explained away. They were at 25,000 and 35,000 feet. So the official story it's been dogged by the 9/11 truth movement, and most particularly by Dr. David Ray Griffin, who is co-founder of the 9/11 consensus panel with myself. He has dogged everything they've done and to escape the appearance of being false and the reality of having a false story. And we're continuing to dog this story through our now 32 consensus points that have the same status as medical consensus statements.
This is important stuff, Elizabeth. What I'd like to do is, as more important information comes out, to get you back on this program so we can highlight it, so hopefully listeners who hear this information will pass it on to others. I think if enough people realize how they were lied to, how they've been scammed, I mean, the official story absolutely doesn't hold water. It didn't from day one, but now we know more, and we will know still more ahead. It's
indeed
important to know this. Otherwise, these wars, which is really the fallout from 9/11, they're going to continue, and I smell another one coming now against Syria.
Absolutely. I know, it's just terrible. How 9/11 was the mother terror event, and it's always referred to. It created a new enemy that's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's hidden. It's something that they can bring out anytime they want to say, now we've got to do this. Now we've got to attack so and so. And you know, General Wesley Clark, he went into the Pentagon right after the attacks. He was a high-ranking U.S. general, and his staff told him, we're going to attack Iraq. And he said, what? And they said, yeah. And he said, well, why? And they said, well, we don't know. We think they feel they have to do something. And he went back to his staff in November, and they laid out the 7 countries in the Middle East that the United States was going to take down in the next 5 years. And he's online as saying that.
Oh, absolutely. We're just about at the end of the program, Elizabeth. I certainly wrote about Wesley Clark, and it's all on a YouTube. I think listeners might be able to find it, where he gave a talk. It might have been in California. Picked up,
yes,
on YouTube. And he wrote a book about it, Waging Modern Wars, if I remember the title. And Wesley Clark, of course, was the NATO commander who ravaged Yugoslavia, Serbia, and Kosovo in 1999. So it's amazing that a guy who did all that would go public and say, they told me they want to destroy 7 countries, but they needed a catalyzing event as the Project for a New American Century, scoundrels, explained before the 9/11 event. And 9/11 was certainly that. A quick final comment, Elizabeth. We are plumb out of time.
Okay. Well, it was nice being on your show again, Stephen, and thank you very much.
Elizabeth, it was wonderful having you on. You absolutely have to come back. We need to continue this and keep hyping on this major, major issue. And I'll just remind listeners, as I always do, join us tomorrow, Saturday and Sunday, at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.